It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for tuning in today. We have two great conversations today, and my first guest is Christian Sander. He's the producer and writer of Hard Miles, a full-length feature film starring Matthew Modine as Greg Townsend, a social worker who takes a group of incarcerated teenage boys on a 762-mile bike trip to the Grand Canyon. It's based on a true story. There really is a Greg Townsend, and he really has taken thousands of kids on this trip. In fact, Greg was on set every day during the shooting of the movie. We'll talk with Christian in a moment. Then it's off to New York City, where I checked in with John Sirico once again. New York is about to pass a bill regulating e-bikes, and there's been a lot of chatter on some of the bike forums about it. After hearing the statistics about e-bikes in New York City, regulation might just be necessary. There's also a new congestion fee going into effect at the end of June, and the money that will be raised will be used for some really important transportation issues. So Brian and I went to a local theater last weekend to watch the new movie Hard Miles, and we loved it. Unlike so many cycling movies that focus on competition, Hard Miles is about how the bicycle can be a vehicle of transformation, especially to kids serving time in a juvenile detention facility. Writer and producer Christian Sander has known about Greg Townsend, the central character in the movie, for quite some time and saw this story as a movie long before he was able to bring it to the screen. Greg is played by award-winning actor Matthew Modine, along with four great young men who learn all about how difficult it is to ride a bike 8 hours a day. Cynthia McWilliams, who was the star of Real Husbands of Hollywood, plays the keep 'em in line psychologist Hattie, who grudgingly drives the sag wagon. Hello, Christian. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How are you?
I'm good, Diane. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So Hard Miles, a new movie about cycling, sort of. It's really about a kind of ragtag group of kids and the guy who decides to set them straight. But it's got bicycles. And so that doesn't happen very often in our business. And I'm very excited. And I know the movie just launched. I saw that there was a release date of June 13th of 2023. Is that true?
Yeah, well, technically, that was our world premiere at the Bentonville Film Festival in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is a really cool up-and-coming fest. It generally celebrates female directors and directors of color, but because it's also such a big bike destination, you know, what the Waltons have done with the place, pouring all that money into infrastructure, we thought it would be a cool place to premiere it. They gave us the honor of the opening spotlight film. And the director happens to be from Arkansas. So it was kind of like a cool fit.
It is. Well, the significance for me is that was my mother's birthday, June 13th. So I immediately...
Yeah, April 19th is our public release. Yeah. So yeah, it's been out for 1 week.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So as we started out, there haven't been a lot of good bicycling movies, and especially in a long while. So Matthew Modine is your star. The movie title is Hard Miles. Give us the premise of the movie. It's already winning a bunch of awards, which is really, really cool. Give us the premise, the basic premise of the movie, and then we'll dive into some of the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, so I co-wrote and produced this movie with my director, RJ Daniel Hanna. And Hard Miles is a story about a social worker at a juvenile detention facility who starts a cycling team at the youth prison. And not only that, but he takes some of these troubled youth on this cross-country bike ride, and they learn the lessons of the open road and have this transformative experience as they bike pack from Denver to the Grand Canyon. It's based on a true story. The real life guy is named Greg Townsend, and he has been doing these bike packing trips for about 30 years, but they also race. So there's two different things. And the students at these, at the facility that Greg works at, they have to kind of earn their way with good behavior onto the cycling team. And then more so if they want to be able to go off site on these bike packing trips, because obviously some of them are flight risks, and you know, you have to earn your way onto the team, kind of like in a regular school, having proper grades.
Yeah. So is the place where these kids are called Ridgeview Cycling Academy, or is that the name in the movie?
Ridgeview Academy is, well, was a real place. It actually got shuttered about a year and a half ago.
Oh.
And it got rolled up into a COVID bill, and they turned it into a homeless shelter facility. So this place still exists, but it shelters the growing homeless problem in Denver instead of troubled youth. But yeah, the facility that runs it all is called Rite of Passage, and Greg Townsend is still running cycling group out of a group home on Mount Blue Sky in Colorado now.
Okay, that's my question. So the group still is there, and he is still doing this event or this
trip. Ridgeview Academy in particular is no more. That existed for 30 years, I think.
Okay.
But before that, Greg did it in Nevada, and after that, he's done it still in Colorado at a smaller facility.
Got it. So let's talk about the cast for a moment. So you do have a super high-profile star name who is playing Greg Townsend. I assume that's not his name in the movie, but Matthew Modine. Is he a cyclist? Did he ride before this movie, or did he have to break his butt in for the movie?
Well, first of all, his name is Greg Townsend in the movie. And not only that, the real Greg Townsend was on set every day we shot.
Cool.
Deeply involved in the project, which was cool. How we got Matthew Modine on a small budget movie like this was because our director, Daniel, had worked with Matthew. Matthew had a smaller role in a film that Daniel directed a couple of years ago, starring Uzo Aduba from Orange is the New Black, called Miss Virginia. It was another biopic. And those two really hit it off on their 3 or 4 days they shot together, kept in touch. And yeah, like you said, Matthew is a cyclist in New York. He's a commuter guy. He'll tell you himself, he's not a Lycra guy, not a big butt butter guy, but he uses his bicycle as his means of transportation in New York City for many, many years.
That's cool. The other guy who does that is David Byrne, Mr. Talking Head. So yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who commute in New York. I mean, why would you want a car? It's crazy.
Yeah.
So what about the kids? Are any of these kids from the actual home?
No, they do such a good job impersonating these characters that you could believe they're not even acting. But no, we got a wonderful, talented cast from our casting director, Ron Pennywell. We had the luxury. There were a few hiccups when we started the process because it was COVID. So the rules kept changing on what you could and couldn't do and how big of a group you could have filming together. SAG-AFTRA had very strict rules, and that all affected the money raising. So what that meant was we had a very long casting process. I think we had 9 months to cast the thing, and we saw hundreds, if not thousands, of talented young actors. But those four really just rose to the top, and I thought they had a wonderful dynamic together.
So let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then we'll kind of go into who each of the characters are. We're speaking with Christian Sander. He is the producer of Hard Miles, a new movie about bicycling and kids who probably lives are changed by bicycling.
It's the transformative power of the bicycle. Absolutely.
And it is so true on so many levels. So let's talk a little bit about the cast other than Matthew, Mr. Commuter, and the four young men who are doing this. What were some of the criteria to get these young men onto your cast, and then to get them to be cyclists? Did they have to know how to, you know, ride a bike a long distance before this?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, first we got Matthew because of Dan's relationship, and he was our anchor. And then Ron Pennywell found us Cynthia K. McWilliams, who's had a very strong career in television, has been in some movies, but she was the perfect yin and yang to this character on paper, Matthew's or Greg Townsend's rigid structure. She was more of a, you know, intellectual slash empathetic figure. And once we had the two grownups in place, then it was all about finding the right four boys to flesh out the team. And what we wanted to do was kind of cover the gamut of all the different reasons that kids end up in a facility like this. And so they come from very different backgrounds, and we wanted each of them to bring something totally unique and different than the other person. And they're not based, there's little nods to real life people for sure, but they're not, they're kind of each an amalgam of 30 years worth of Greg Townsend's stories of kids that have gone through his school. So, you know, Joaquin Guillory, he plays Woolbright, who's kind of this natural born leader, but doesn't trust anyone because the adults have kind of abandoned him in his life. Damian Diaz plays Atencio, he's kind of this hardened gangbanger, but he's really just using that as a shield to, you know, the difficulties in his own life. Jackson Kelly plays Smink, who is from a broken home and comes in there with an eating disorder, and he's just very fragile compared to these more bravado type guys. And then Zach T. Robbins plays Rice, who is kind of there for partying, and he's more of like the comic relief, and not, he's, I would say, less in a less precarious position than the other four boys, but provides some levity to the situation. And it's kind of, we hope that it kind of covered the gamut of, like I said, all the reasons that a young man might end up in one of these alternative schools slash facilities.
How much riding did they have to do?
They're all pretty athletic, which helped, but none of them were really cyclists before we started shooting. I mean, they all knew how to ride a bicycle, but no one had ever clipped in on SPDs before, you know, or looks for that matter. So we hired Dorothy Wong, who is a cross champion, a certified cycling instructor, and she put the guys through cone drills and clipping in and clipping out. And we only had a couple of days before we started shooting. And so, but we had Dorothy and we had Greg Townsend there, and Greg has taught a lot of young men how to ride a bicycle in this way. And one of the cool things was, over the course of the shoot, we did shoot kind of chronologically, so in story order for the most part. And you could kind of see that they got a hang of it as the shoot rolled on. So it became very natural on screen.
That's cool, because I know, having done multi-day tours, you know, you start out, day one is one thing, but by day eight, you know, it's a completely different experience and you are in the saddle a different way. So I get exactly what you're saying.
Right. And I did put a Garmin on them just to see how much they were riding a day. And it was usually like 15 miles, which for an experienced cyclist, no big deal.
But wait, 50? 5-0?
1-5.
Oh, 15. That's not bad.
You know, not bad, but they're also having to remember their lines and their right. Blocking and emote and do all this other stuff. So it was a lot going on to do for 24 days.
Right. Oh, is that how long it took to take this to shoot the movie?
Yeah, we had 24 shoot days and a few pickups.
Wow. I would have thought it would take longer, but I think that's really cool that you got it done in 24 days.
Well, once the cameras start rolling, time is money. So you got to go, go, go.
That is true. That is true. So what kind of bikes were they riding?
They were riding Franken bikes. But
everybody knows what that means on this show.
Everybody on your show would know that. But the cool thing was, these Franken bikes, the frames were all welded by real Ridgeview students.
Really?
Yeah. So most of them were aluminum. I think there was one or two titanium bikes. But Greg Townsend, in the movie and in real life, teaches welding class so that these kids can graduate with a welding cert and they can get a job welding if they so choose. And they get to make their own bikes, which also teaches them how to kind of have pride in something that they own and made and take care of. And that's another one of Greg's lessons. But yeah, they were riding the real bikes welded by former students, which was cool.
That is cool. That is really cool.
My favorite one had an old school, like 1980s Le Mans fork, like, you know, the one that's like ketchup and mustard.
Yeah.
Bright yellow with the red Le Mans.
Yeah.
So Greg Le Mans donated a bunch of parts to Greg Townsend back in the day, too, which made their way into the film.
That's cool. So Greg Le Mans now is doing carbon fiber stuff.
Yeah. Well, a few of them did have carbon. The titanium bike that Woolbright rides had carbon components.
Yeah.
But they were all Frankenbikes and needing constant. Greg Townsend was our sag wagon. The sag wagon that appears in the film is his real wagon. And he was pretty much constantly fixing the bikes and helping our production designer, Susanna Lober, is a big cyclist, very capable. And our prop master, Nils, some of the grip team wrote, like, there were a lot of cyclists on the actual physical production staff, which was cool. And it helped.
They probably all loved it, too.
Oh, yeah. And it helped, too, if you had like a flat or a brake cable needed to be reattached. It was like we kept going pretty quickly because everybody had been through it.
What's been the audience response so far? What are you getting in feedback?
Oh, it's been wonderful. We won, I think, 3 audience awards during our festival run. And people are loving it this week. I think we just took a hit with some critics, but I think we were 93% or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes in our first week. So I think it's a crowd pleaser.
Everybody's a critic, you know? In fact, I'm more likely to see a film if a critic hands it.
I will say it, when the audience score is beating the critic score, I generally like that movie.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. Such a cool project. So I want to tell people that the film is out now. Check your local theaters. It's called Hard Miles. We're speaking with producer Christian Sander. So you've done some really high profile stuff. This is kind of a little thing compared to Fast and Furious.
Well, I should mention that I was low man on the totem pole. I have been an assistant or an intern at some very high profile producers' offices, but I wasn't very hands on in some of those blockbuster hits. I'm very much trying to make a name for myself still as an independent producer and got a lot in the hopper. But thank you for shouting it out. Right now is a chance to check it out in theaters, because we will be out on digital later this summer. But it is best experienced on the big screen. It's rare that an indie movie gets a theatrical release. But our cinematographer, Mac Fisher, chose to shoot anamorphic. And it takes you out into the sweeping American West vistas. And it makes you feel like you are on the bicycle out in these awesome places. So it's worth it checking out on the big screen if you can, just for that reason alone.
And it is filmed in Colorado?
We shot mostly in California.
Oh, okay.
Lone Pine and Arizona, but we did also shoot in Colorado, mostly the second unit.
The storyline is a Colorado storyline, though.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Right. So how are you with this project? I mean, is this like one of the favorite things you've ever done?
I'm really proud of this project. And it's interesting because when Greg Townsend's story came across my desk many years ago, it was originally from some reporting by Tracy Ross in Bicycling Magazine.
Uh-huh.
She wrote a wonderful article about this guy. And there's a few other articles, but hers is the best. And the more I read about this guy, the more I thought, hey, his story sounds like a classic sports drama movie. Like, it has all the elements. You just need to give a little Hollywood flair. But I wasn't much of a cyclist before writing the script with Dan, but afterwards I'm totally sucked down the wormhole and I love the sport now. And
welcome to our sport. It's been my life since I was in my 20s. So I totally get it. It is captivating. I'm more into the machine and I ride a tandem, but with my husband.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, it's very
cool. That's on my N+1 with my wife. I've got the gravel. She's got the e-bike. Next, we need a tandem.
So here's our philosophy on tandems. And everybody who listens knows that this is true. Whatever direction your relationship is going, we'll get there much faster on a tandem. So we've had people get a tandem thinking it was going to save them. And it definitely did not. And we had people who literally fell in love and have ridden tandems for years like we did. And that is the God's truth. No kidding.
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, Christian, thank you so much for talking with me again. We're speaking with Christian Sander. He is the producer of Hard Miles, a brand new movie with Matthew Modine about bicycling and kids and hard times. And I just think it's awesome. I'm so happy that you produced this. Get to your theater and see it. Is there a website just for the movie?
There is. You can go to hardmilesmovie.com or bluefoxentertainment.com has a page as well. They both have theater lookups and more information about the film.
And we'll have that on our website. Thanks so much. And keep riding. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Diane.
You're welcome.
My thanks to Christian Sander for joining me on the show today. I had not seen the film before I spoke with him. I'd only seen the trailer. But the film lives up to everything Christian said, and I'd highly recommend it. If you can't find a big screen in your area, it will be available streaming later on this summer. We have a link to the trailer and to the website on our site, OutspokenCyclist.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with John Sirico about e-bike regulations in New York, as well as the congestion pricing that will go into effect at the end of June. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. With almost 700,000 daily cycling trips in New York City, John Sirico estimates that at least half of them are on e-bikes. And with that kind of ridership, there are a lot of issues that are beginning to affect transportation in the city. So what's the next step? Probably regulation. There is a bill about to be brought up for a vote in the state legislature. In addition to what that legislation might look like and who will be affected by it, John and I talk about congestion pricing that will charge cars being driven into Manhattan and how that money will be used to update public transportation, among other things. Hi, John. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's always good to catch up with you and learn what's happening in New York City and the state. Actually, New York City's in the news a whole lot these days, not necessarily in a good way, but let's start with that for a second. Just, you know, are things calming down at all, or is it still insane?
I would say it's been, a very frenetic week or two, a couple weeks now for New York City. It always is frenetic. I mean, if you remember 2 weeks ago, the Trump trial was also in the news. So it's just been like nonstop news coverage. And I think as a college professor myself, it's, been a really kind of confusing, frenetic, especially as someone who teaches seniors. You know, these are a group of college students that didn't have a high school graduation because of the pandemic. So it's just like been jarring from a lot of different angles.
Yeah. I hope it calms down soon.
Me too.
All right. So I had a listener getting, actually, I think it was the touring list now that I think about it, mm-hmm. who was saying that New York is proposing some e-bike regulations.
Yep.
There was a lot of chatter about it. People were pro, con, whatever. Let's start with what are the proposed regulations, and then let's move on to what you think might happen.
Yeah, sure. So I would say the most salient one for this conversation is a state bill that is being proposed by one of the mayor's most closest allies, Jennifer Rajkumar. And it calls for basically a registration for all e-bikes. Now, whether that bill will pass, it remains up in the air. As this e-bike issue in general has this problem, it has a really odd set of bedfellows. I mean, like, you have conservatives who like this bill, you have liberals that like this bill, but it's unclear whether it will be enough to pass it in the end. But basically, this would be a bill that everyone who owns a pedal assister or electric bike would have to register, almost like a DMV registration. I would say the proponents argue that this will be a better way to crack down on unruly cycling behavior, which is really the cause of the bill. I mean, blowing through red lights, all the kind of, biking on the sidewalk, biking wrong way down the one way. The critics, I would say, argue that it criminalizes a lot of folks, especially who are undocumented, who are doing deliveries, who are, I would say, a lot of the ire towards e-bikes are towards the delivery drivers. So it's been really an interesting conversation because it hits on all these different issues of labor and, privacy and kind of government involvement in a market like that. But at the same time, I think it's been really hard to find a middle ground because I think I have so many friends who argue about this all the time. It's such a number one conversation right now in New York is the e-bikes and like knowing we need them, but also a lot of folks feeling like they're getting almost hit every single day. And I think it's really hard to find a middle ground because of those issues I just mentioned. And I don't think we've found it yet. And I don't think the transit community and transit advocacy community has really found it yet either. So it's been this kind of strange trying to find out what this gray space is. How do you kind of crack down on that?
Can you estimate how many e-bikes are privately owned? Because I know we also have, yeah. you actually have e-bikes that are rentable. You have a renting
yes.
system.
And just to get a sense of that scale, which I just recently heard this from Citibike, for a long time, so Citibike is averaging now almost 200,000 daily rides, which is remarkable.
Whoa.
It's pretty crazy. In the summer, I think they're going to blow past every record they've held. But back in the day, it used to be 30% of that was electric bikes. Then it's gone up to 40, then it's gone up to 50. And most recently, about 2/3 of all Citibike rides are on the electric bikes because people are just obsessed with them because they're so fast. You could fly all over, you know, they're reliable, all the things. I would say privately owned. That's a great question. I mean, if we're thinking almost, 700,000 daily cycling trips are happening in New York, which again is probably an undercount and a crazy number. I think anecdotally, I could say that at least half of the bikes that I see, myself included, I have an electric bike.
Right.
Are on an e-bike.
Wow. So interesting.
It's really taken off. It's scaled so fast. And I think to the point about e-bike registration, I think government is really, really playing catch up because this industry just really shifted fast.
Well, I was going to assume, clearly incorrectly, that it wasn't about driving or riding in an unruly manner. I was going to assume that it had to do with safety of the bike itself, the fires and all the other issues.
So there's this too. Yeah.
Okay. So that's included.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the e-bike safety, because what's so interesting about the e-bike itself and just this whole new economy that we're basically seeing that's being delivered by electric bike is that it touches so many different agencies, right? So fire safety is fire department, and that's and they're really pushing at the federal level to try to ban these, basically these batteries are coming in completely off the truck and just completely unregulated. And, there's these shops that are charging 20 of them at once and they're exploding. I mean, that's the problem. So they're pushing for federal regulations, the fire department, while also trying to get folks to just securely charge more. And they're doing some interesting pilots to do that. Some public charging pilots, which is very cool, but that's different than the e-bike registration. That's like a safety regulation. But then you also have these like minimum wage guidelines that are kind of more labor relations and consumer protection. So you have all these different agencies. And this is really why I think one of the last times we talked, the city's really pushing to create this new department that would be the Department of Sustainable Deliveries, the way they've called it, that would also try to wrap all these things in one agency because it's touching so many different places. And even the delivery drivers and e-bike riders don't really know what's legal, what's not. Right. Some things are allowed, some things are not. It's so unclear. And I think that kind of lack of order is creating a lot of headaches for folks.
Let me reintroduce you, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the congestion in New York and whether there's going to be a surcharge to bringing cars in. We're speaking with John Sirico. We talk to him as often as we can about what's going on in New York City. He has his ear to the ground for everything that has to do with sustainability, planning, cool stuff that's going on. And he's an educator. He's a journalist. If you don't already read it, Street Beat is his Substack newsletter. Just got this one for April. It was fascinating. And I always love the pictures that you add to it.
Uh-huh. Thanks,
the pictures are sort of, you look at the photographs and you go, what does that really mean? And then you have to read.
Yeah. I'm glad I put a lot of thought in them. So I appreciate that.
And they're not self-explanatory.
No.
So we have the e-bike regulations maybe coming up. Do you know when they might come up for either discussion or vote or?
Yeah, so it's up in the state, and the state is over pretty. The session's over pretty soon, so they have about a month or two to pass it. So that's a pretty short runway to pass a bill. So it would, if it doesn't happen this session, it gets kicked to next year. So we'll see.
What's your sense?
My sense is that it's a really sensitive topic, and I think because of that, like you have basically conservatives and more center Democrats that I think are more willing to think about registering e-bikes. But most of Albany is controlled by progressive Democrats who want to represent the deliveristas and want to worry about these labor relations. So I think that, I don't know. I haven't seen yet that they've built the political lines for it to pass yet.
All right. Well, I guess we'll keep watching that and it'll be another opportunity to chat.
Yeah.
So I was speaking with somebody in London yesterday and she's finding it so much better to cycle in London right now because of the congestion pricing and just people staying out of London proper. I'm wondering what's going on in New York City. Are they going to start charging for people to bring their cars in or better yet, to keep them out?
Yeah. Yeah. So, the MTA, you know, our main public transit agency, has announced that June 30th, the cameras will flick on. That's the official start date for congestion pricing. That is also, that's barring any, so congestion pricing in New York right now faces like a multitude of lawsuits, one from the entire state of New Jersey, one from the borough of Staten Island, one from residents in downtown Manhattan, all arguing basically this is regressive, they didn't do enough review, this is going to lead to more traffic going elsewhere. I think one thing to keep in mind is that the bill passed in 2019 and they've done about 5 years of environmental review. So that's the MTA's argument, that we've been studying this for a really long time. We've done all the work that's needed and they're confident the lawsuits won't go forward. But should all the lawsuits go away or get settled in some way, the cameras will flick on June 30th and private drivers will be charged $15 to enter Manhattan, 60th Street and below during peak hours. At nighttime, that drops pretty immensely to like $4 or $3.75. Trucks will have to pay a lot more. Trucks will have to pay between $24 and $36. Cabs only have a small surcharge because they already pay a kind of congestion surcharge already. Motorcycles will pay about half of 15, so about $7.50. And then there'll be exemptions for people who already live in downtown Manhattan, already live in this zone. So there'll be some exemptions there for low-income residents, things like that. So they've done all sorts of things to figure out how do we make this happen. Really, I would say London is the playbook for sure. I mean, London has had the congestion charge now since the early 2000s. And what it did, I think, so strategically is that right before, in the lead up to congestion pricing in London, they just absolutely maximized bus service and absolutely maximized ways to get around central London. And now, you know, 10 to 15 years later, as your friend's experiencing and I experienced when I lived there for a while, they just were, once you free the kind of central area of a bunch of traffic, you could do a lot of things. You could carve out huge bike lanes. You could do bus only lanes. You could pedestrianize areas. So central London has really gone through this transformation where it is as close to a pedestrian cycling arena that it really has ever looked, probably since the 1800s. So it's been pretty remarkable to see like what it's been able to do there. And I think New York maybe hasn't done as much work in the lead up. There's some things happening now where we're finally boosting bus service. We're doing a lot of bike lane work, but it's going to be really interesting to see what happens after June 30th.
Was pollution ever a piece of this congestion pricing? Did people talk about the clean air situation?
Yeah. So actually, this idea has been kicked around for a long time, since about the 50s and 60s. The original intent in the 70s was around when the Environmental Protection Agency was created, the Clean Air Act, and a lot of it was completely clean air focused. Like, we need to reduce traffic because of air quality. Then 20 years later, when Mayor Bloomberg brought it back up, Bloomberg really pushed for congestion pricing as mayor. Similarly, he said, clean air, but also public transit upgrades. That really was key. I would say this last iteration, so we're now on the third charm, it's less about clean air. I would say it's more about carbon emissions and public transit upgrades, which I think is the key thing. Like, we have a failing public transit system. It's historically underinvested in. We need money for it to do the things we want to do to modernize the MTA subway system and add bus and do all these and build new trains. We need a new source of revenue. And I think that's been more of the argument, that we need a really modern public transit system, which I think is what ended up selling it. I personally think it was a better argumentative tool to say that than just like clean air. I think you need like all the things, but I think seeing the quid pro quo, this money will pay for elevators at your subway station. It will pay for modern signals. It will pay for a new Brooklyn Queens train, which is in the works. Like, it will pay for all these things, I think was a better argumentative tool.
Did anybody have any idea of what kind of money we're talking about, what the income might be on maybe a monthly basis with congestion pricing? Do you have any idea?
So the MTA is projecting that they're going to be able to raise $1 billion a year from this, which is remarkable.
Holy smokes, they could actually get some stuff done.
Yeah. So, and then I think, yeah, and I think also like there is a fair argument that like, hey, the MTA doesn't have the best track record, no pun intended, not best track record of, you know, delivering projects on time, on budget, which is a completely fair argument. I think that's one of the more reasonable ones where like the MTA, you know, is delayed a lot in cost overruns. But I think you can match that accountability, put in more transparency measures, budgeting measures, while still delivering on huge transit upgrades across the board.
Cool. That's really cool stuff. So let's just segue into one more thing, and that is, what are you doing? I know that you just are doing more different, better things all the time. This school year is coming to an end.
Yes.
So
yes.
What's happening over the spring and summer?
Yeah, we just had our last class of the semester 2 days ago, which is crazy to think. The students produced such amazing work. I got to say, after like such a trying couple of weeks, just like still produced incredible work about
this. That's great.
Which is really great to see. And I'm really excited to read the final drafts next week of their last work. I'm teaching, co-teaching with another professor, a new summer course where that's basically just going to be a newsroom where we're going to send students out into the summer of New York and report, which I'm really excited about. I have a couple stories coming out. I will be, I'm writing a story about cargo bikes, which I'm really excited about. We have all these new rules in New York about cargo bikes, which is really fascinating and potentially could be transformative. You know, if we're able to really get trucks off the street, especially thinking about congestion pricing. So I'm really excited about that story. I got a story coming out about different bus lanes in the city. So I've been writing a ton and working on some projects at the think tank I work at, Center for Urban Future, about CUNY, about managing public space, about all sorts of different things related to the climate and sustainability.
So you mentioned it, CUNY, and I know CUNY's been in the news a lot this past week. And yes. I'm not sure if people understand the significance of the City University of New York.
Yes.
Yeah. So we have Cleveland State University, which is what we used to call a sort of a commuter school. You know, it's a university and it's big
and it has
quite a few interesting colleges and has gotten much more popular over the years. But these downtown campuses are really important.
Totally.
And so I'm wondering how CUNY is dealing with the situation right now and whether it sees itself as needing to do something different for the next school year, maybe.
Yeah. You know, I think what's so interesting about CUNY specifically, so right, it's like the biggest urban public university system. It's massive. It serves like, you know, hundreds of thousands of students. And it largely that student body is first generation. First person in the family to go to college, low income, person of color, you know, just, you know, truly an economic mobility engine that we like to call it. And I think the hard problem with CUNY is that like any other public institution, it seems like similar to the subway, similar to our roads, everything, they're historically underinvested in. So they have really old buildings that are really falling apart. And, you know, and we see it, you know, a lot of the protests this week, because there is also protests at CUNY. A lot of it's related to just like we're spending so much money elsewhere. We should be spending it on this public institution. The kind of recent work that I've done with CUNY relates to their buildings because they're so old, they're so energy intensive. And we basically made the argument at Center for Durham Future that they would be a great model to start to think about bringing to net zero decarbonizing because they're so old. You know, how about we pair their long needed renovations with decarbonization, especially thinking how much money is coming in from Washington right now. And also in New York State, there's a lot of efforts being made to decarbonize buildings. Like, let's take this kind of moment in history to finally fund CUNY the way CUNY needs to be funded. This really important, vital, I would say, public institution. And, you know, the kind of crux of it all is like, let's use this amazing student body that's so talented, faculty that's so talented to really lead this effort because it could be incredible real world green job training, essentially. But I think the CUNY state, I mean, it's amazing what they're able to do, given that the buildings are like quite literally falling apart in some campuses and they're able to just like still succeed and still have this like really robust student body. But it shouldn't be the case, especially knowing that we need these buildings to go green if we're going to cut carbon emissions. So
how is the let me rephrase it. So what did this disruption do to take away from what's really important about CUNY? You know, is it going to color the future in a way that might be a deterrent to investing?
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. I think it's definitely something to consider. CUNY, like every single year, is always like fighting to keep its funding. And I think that the mayor largely controls that purse for New York City schools, and the governor does as well. You know, and I think that's something that politically they have to toe a really fine line about what they say in hearings, because they ultimately have to really acquiesce to the city, to the mayor and the governor. So it remains to be seen what this last couple of weeks, you know, how it affects their funding and how it affects what they're able to do. But I would say that, yeah, I'm not surprised that a lot of the rancor on campus is also about the fact that the buildings are falling apart at their university. Yeah. We saw a similar thing happen actually at when Amazon tried to build HQ2 in New York, and New York basically said no to that, or like, we're not going to give you tax breaks. There was a huge CUNY protest for a long time, basically saying like, why are we giving tax breaks when I can't even go to school without leaks in my building, right? So you've seen this come up in their protest movements, this actual state of campus. And I think you're seeing it come up again too.
Well, to me, that might be worth protesting about. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of protests right now that I can't even get into it in my brain, that I don't even think the students understand exactly what they're protesting. So we won't go there. All right. Well, I'm excited to talk to you in the fall. I want to know more about these new rules on cargo bikes. We can talk about that next time.
Yeah, a lot to say there.
The congestion pricing goes into effect, how it's doing. So how are they going to collect? This is just a question I meant to ask before.
Sure.
As you drive into the city, are they using your Easy Pass to?
Exactly. So, you know, and I think this was the argument for why the MTA was the best suited, because under Bloomberg's proposal, the city was going to really run the system. And basically, I think there was an argument that like, actually, the MTA already has Easy Pass, already has this infrastructure put in place,
right,
to do this. So, it will be your Easy Pass. The cameras are already up. I mean, like you can see them if you go around. They're just not live yet. But yeah, they'll basically be clocking you as you come in. And then there's all these like things. You know, if you're just taking the arterials, like the FDR Drive, the highways along Manhattan, that doesn't count. It's really entering the residential streets, right?
Sure.
It's so clogged by, I mean, endless traffic and trucks, right, and things. So yeah, it will be your Easy Pass. It will be linked to your license. You would get a bill later on. And that's when the exemptions, all that would come into play.
Well, as always, it's a fascinating conversation. I love hearing what's going on in New York. We've been speaking with John Sirico. We talk to him as often as possible. If you do not already subscribe, go to Substack and type in Street Beats. It's a wonderful newsletter. It's once a month. It's very inexpensive and it's money well spent. I see it come through every month and I'm like, oh yeah, there's a new Street Beats newsletter coming out. And that, reminded back, you know, sort of in a backwards way, which is kind of cool.
I usually get some comment from a reader about the picture of my cat that ends every.
Oh, yeah. I should start sending you pictures of the dog. My little Izzy. Thanks so much, John. Have a great summer. We'll talk again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Diane.
All right. As always, it's great to speak with John Sirico. We will follow the e-bike regulation bill and check back in with John after congestion pricing goes into effect later this summer. Meanwhile, you can keep abreast of what John is doing by subscribing to his newsletter, Street Beat, on Substack. Even if you don't live in New York City, John's insights are most enlightening on a variety of topics. I'd like to take a moment to thank all of you who have shared your favorite trails with me. I'm compiling them for an upcoming series of shows. It's amazing to me how few duplicates I received, so I can't wait to start sharing them with you. Please remember that you can find links, photos, a transcript, and a download link for every episode at OutspokenCyclist.com. Of course, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite app. You'll never miss an episode that way. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I just can't seem to call it X. And my thanks to you for listening. I'll be back soon with another new episode of the show. I hope you're having a great riding season. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.